Thank you for being here. This has been a fabulous conference so far. I spent most of my time right in here and heard the discussions that went on in here, and they were wonderful. But I've heard from all the other breakout sessions that heard great reports. So just as kind of a wrap up this afternoon, we've put our presenters on a panel for questions, and I've got many written questions, so we'll do some of those, and then if you have other questions that you would just like to ask, we have volunteers with some microphones that will come around. They are part of the Dixie basketball team, so they're fast. So don't start your question until they get to you, but they'll be fast. So just be patient. As you stand up, we'll get that question. Maybe we should quickly introduce our panel. Maybe we just take a second and introduce yourself again. Would that be all right if you just went down the row and introduced yourself just real briefly?
Go ahead. Sure. You can start right here.
I'm Rachel Kirksick. I live in Cedar City, Utah, and I was part of the women's panel. Just telling a little bit about my story and going through my own personal recovery through my ex-husband's pornography addiction and different experiences that I have. So.
I'm Shaylee Ellis, and I currently live in Henderson, Nevada, and I too was a part of the women's panel where we had a question and answer about some of the things that we've dealt with as spouses who or partners who are married to sexual addicts.
My name's Sharla Jessup, and I live in Dallas, Texas, and I was a part of the women's panel as well. And my husband and I we have three kids, and he's in strong recovery for, I think, the past about 3 years, so thanks.
My name's Clay Olson. I'm with Fight the New Drug and Fortify.
I'm Jeff Stewart. I'm a local therapist with LifeStar, and I taught the workshop on pornography, how to talk about pornography in a dating relationship.
I'm Kristen Jensen, and I'm the author of Good Pictures, Bad Pictures. I blog at Pornproof Kids, and I taught a class on the 5 steps to inoculating your kids against pornography, and I'm out of Washington State.
I'm Daniel Weiss. I come from Amro, Wisconsin. It's the only Amro in the world because it's an anglicized version of a French trapper's name. So if you've been in Amro, you've been in someplace special. But I was on the panel this morning talking to religious leaders, spiritual leaders, on how to address issues of pornography, and then give the keynote address.
I'm Stephen Bangeter. I'm from St. George, Utah. That's a Mormonized version of a Catholic title. And I'm a stake president in the LDS Church here and participated in the panel with Daniel regarding the ministry of church leaders to members of their congregation who struggle with pornography.
My name is Amy Clough. I'm a therapist here in St. George. I hosted the panel of women who are spouses of those who struggle with pornography. I specialize in trauma and attachment and work a lot with children, have a lot of experience also working with children who have been exposed to pornography or might even start to have trouble at a young age, so I welcome your questions that way also.
Thank you. We'll just begin with a few written questions, and then as you have questions, I'll open it up to raise your hand and ask questions if you'd like. Let's begin down at Daniel and Stephen Bangeter with how do we address the joy and positivity of sex and sexuality in a church setting? Daniel, would you start with that?
Yeah, I think before I go to the how, briefly, the why, I spoke to it a little bit about in my speech here. I really strongly believe a lot of what we're seeing in the culture, in the church, in our families, is the result of silence. And I was speaking with someone earlier, we've given our kids a series of no's. No, don't do that till you're married. Don't do that till you're married. And those are good, helpful cautions, but we've never told them what the yes is. And so when they get married, we're suddenly flipping the script for them, and a lot of people, and we know this, and therapists, you know, deal with this regularly, they don't know how to flip the script. And I suggest maybe we should start with a series of yeses that help our children and our adults, frankly, understand how to live our lives in accordance with how God made us and created us, who he called us to be. And so that's the why. The how is, and again, I spoke to it a little bit earlier, I like to talk about issues of identity because what we do, that is our actions or our behaviors, flow out of who we are or often who we think we are. So if we have a misunderstanding of who we are as a man or a woman, a boy or a girl, our actions are going to flow out of that misunderstanding. But if we are given the truth and if we're able to embrace that, then our actions are going to flow out of that core sense of truth, the truth of our being. And that's kind of how I approach it from a church setting, because we get caught up in talking about behavior and, you know, that's not appropriate in this setting. Yeah, I agree with that. A lot of times it's not. You can do the foundational work in the group setting and then in the specialized work in more appropriate settings is how I would approach it.
I so often see with, particularly with our youth, but also with adults, and especially in our initial meetings, a sense of shame that seems to hover over them. They're embarrassed to talk about what they're struggling with. They are ashamed of the things that they're doing. They've often spoken with someone about it, and on occasion have been put down for their behaviors. I love to begin with them by helping them understand that our Father in heaven, that God has not departed from them, that the very things that they are acting upon derive out of feelings innate within them, created within them, desires and passions that are God-given, healthy, and meant to draw sons and daughters of God together to establish healthy and wholesome relationships. In our breakout session, I mentioned a personal example. The greatest minister I ever knew was my father, who taught me to understand at a very young age there are wonderful, healthy feelings that grow out of those passions. If I could learn, and I was because of his teachings and the way I was brought up, if I could learn to act on the healthy passions that were within me and learn to bridle and properly use those passions, the joy that I would experience in life would be so much more fulfilling than acting upon them in an unhealthy or unwholesome manner. Learning the difference became the key. So I think that one of the most important things we can help our youth and our adults understand is the manner in which to direct the training of ourselves to guard and preciously cultivate the private times of our lives so that those private times of our lives are filled with the wonderful goodness that comes from acting on the passions God put within us naturally.
Thank you. Thank you, both of you. Let's address this one to Kristen. How can we advocate against pornography in our communities? I live outside Utah in the West Coast. And I think this is a great question. We've learned a whole bunch today. What are we going to do with that? Where are we going to take it? What is the next step? Help us with that.
Okay, well, I think in Clay's presentation, he talks about how we need... Okay, I'm sorry. Thank you. I know in Clay's presentation, he talks about that this is a public health crisis. And so if we take it out of the moral realm and talk about it as a public health crisis, I believe it can really reach more widely, that message. The other thing is, and a story I shared in my class, is that when we empower our children, they will get us to make changes. And there was a little five-year-old who was taught, you know, what pornography is, and she identified it when she saw it in a magazine at the grocery store. She pointed to it, and she said, "That's pornography." What did her mom do? She said, "You're right. You know, to her, my little girl, that is pornography. That's a sexualized image." And so she took it up with the manager. She wrote a letter to the company, and that the vice president got back in touch with her. They took off all the Cosmo magazines from the checkout stands of that grocery store and put them in another place with covers. So that's just one small action. There's many actions. I don't know. I don't think we realize the power that we have as individuals. We think that a million people have to say something before anyone will listen, and that's not true. One person, one child spoke up, and that company made a change in Lincoln, Nebraska. Well, I think changes can be made in St. George, Utah, and anywhere we live if we'll just start to speak up. And as we teach our children, they'll hold us accountable as they do. So I think there are many actions. I just want to add one more thing. When I was living in California, we had a sports bar that wanted to open up. It was just like a few blocks down from our elementary school in this neighborhood, this new brand new neighborhood. And we're like, what? Well, a little group of us got together to try to stand up to the big developer and the guy who was buying off the school board and all this. And you know what? We won. And 12 people wrote letters to the Alcohol and Tobacco Bureau. I'm not sure the name of it, but it was the one that gave out the liquor licenses. 12 people. I was one of them. And you know what? They never got their license. So you don't have to have 100,000 people or even 1,000 people. It's amazing if we will all start speaking up at various opportunities, what we can do and the power we have.
Thank you. Thank you. Allison, could you stand up so that our basketball player can get you a microphone? I'd like you just to share what you have done here in St. George in the elementary school that received the iPads and what you've done in our community.
And my children go to the school that just opened that is a STEM school, and they each have iPads. So we decided to have a week. We pulled it from the White Ribbon Week and then engaged a lot of parents in planning how we could help start a conversation with our kids starting at kindergarten about what's appropriate online and what isn't. And so we have gone through and helped a communication pattern start where the teachers give a little bit in the every day that morning, and then the kids do activities with us at lunch to reinforce what they're learning, and then we send home information every night to the parents that encourage a conversation to happen. One of those is keep talking. It says if you see anything that makes you uncomfortable, make sure and tell a parent. And then we had invited Jeff Stewart two years in a row to come and do a parent night with the parents so that when the kids come home and say, I'm uncomfortable, the parents know what to say and how to have that conversation. So we do that yearly and also do something once a month to just help that conversation happen in the homes of small children.
Thank you. She wasn't on our panel. Let's give her a hand. But that, I felt like she was a great example of what a parent could do in their own community, in their own schools, to proactively look forward to an issue of the students all getting iPads and how to deal with that before there are big issues on how to help them and help them deal with those things.
Could I just say whiteribbonweek.org? Check it out. They've got a lot of great, at least three different curriculums for White Ribbon Week at schools.
Thank you. Thank you. Clay, I'm going to direct this one to you. You and Jeff, maybe. And there's three questions that all go together. And I'm sure that both of you can handle these. What are the most common motivators for someone to get into the porn industry? To what degree do you think the porn stars actually enjoy what they're doing, if any? And how does the porn industry justify the negative impact that it has on society?
Okay. Number one was, what's the main motivating factor for a lot of these? So we get a lot of emails from women that were once involved, in fact, some men that were once involved in the pornography industry, telling us what's really going on. And oftentimes, the story that they tell is quite different than what the media tells us about what's really going on in the industry. One of the main motivating factors, in fact, we just did a video with a woman named Jessica, based out of Kansas, who jumped into the pornography industry based off of some, and she talks about her motivating factors. That video will be coming out shortly on our website. But her main motivating factor, and what we see for many of them, is money. They often feel like they don't have really a choice, and so in order to pay the bills and in order to pay these things, they jump into it for those reasons. However, I will also address the fact that many of those individuals that are involved in the pornography industry didn't actually choose to do that. It wasn't a choice of like, oh, I need some money, or this is something I want to do. It wasn't a career choice. Many of them, more often, more than we think, were actually forced into that industry against their wills. And I have come across many women and young women who were forced into that industry against their wills and forced to behave the way that they did. And many of them actually were forced to make it look like it was a consensual act. One woman said that there was a gun off camera pointed at her head, telling her that if she didn't make it look like she was agreeing to those actions, that they would kill her. And yet millions upon millions of people today are consuming this material thinking, well, that's a career choice. They chose this. And so if there are any impacts on the world, it's just going to be on me and I can deal with that. But what we realize is that what we click, we support. And what we're supporting in many cases is the total and utter exploitation of women. And we're supporting violence against women, according to a recent study on what the pornography is delivering today. And nearly 90% of it involves aggression and violence against women. And so a lot of these women aren't there for a choice. Those that did choose to do it, oftentimes it is the money.
Thank you. Do you have anything to add to that?
I think that was really good. I think Clay's had a lot more experience with people in the industry than I have. The thing I do have a lot of experience with, though, is a little bit different. And so Clay's talking about what we would call professional pornography. And I want to speak to just for a minute about which is more of the run-of-the-mill kind of garden variety pornography that a lot of young girls and young women, and even older women, are pressured into producing on their phones, on social media, or in other relationships, taking pictures of themselves and other kinds of things, which is pornography, and they've objectified themselves. And I think the Kite Sisters did an excellent job of describing that problem. And the root of it isn't about money. The root of it for them is about believing that their worth and value comes from how they're viewed. And that starts with something as simple as just taking lots of pictures of yourself, selfies, and it evolves into believing that the more likes, the more praise you get, the more you focus on your body. And it's a slippery slope. Where do you stop? And so I think that there's a lot of faulty beliefs around worth and value and appearance that drive people to produce more of that type of pornography. And then you've got the darker side of the sexual exploitation, the abuse, the addiction, and the slavery that Clay talked about.
Thank you. This next question I'm going to address to all three of you. Well, maybe we'll even get Amy in on this one too, but what can family members do to help support partners and those struggling with addiction? So what can family members do to help and support partners and those struggling with addiction?
So my family was very supportive. I grew up in a very open family environment, which was very helpful for this situation. So my family, they always supported our marriage. And so when I would tell them something that was awful that I was going through because of my husband, they never belittled him or made him feel or even thought ill of him. They obviously didn't like the situation, but when we did visits or sometimes my husband would call my dad for help and advice because he knew my dad would not judge him. And so my parents have had experience with addiction in other areas in the family, and so they were aware of you don't hate the person, but you love them and you support them and you give the person to God. And so they were able to love my husband. And then for me, they did want my marriage to last, and so they would support and just let me talk and give spiritual guidance. And I felt like just the fact of me being able to unload stuff was very healing to me with my safe family environment.
I'm just going to emphasize what Charlotte said in supporting the marriage. Be on the side of the marriage. I think it's very easy to want to side with one person or the other, especially if you are a parent and you're seeing your son and or daughter or in-laws or whatever go through this. But the most important thing that you can do is find out what they want the outcome to be and side with the marriage. And then the other thing that I will add to that is I think that it was brought up in the closing presentation was to check back in with family members. A lot of times as you're going through this and you're dealing with all of this stuff happening to your life, you don't always know what to do or what kind of help is needed. And it's very difficult, especially if your spouse has slipped back into the addiction, and to call up a friend or a family member and say, I'm in hell again, please help me, drag me out, whatever you have to do, because it very much makes it a reality to have to make that phone call and say, hey, my life is falling apart once again, I need help. That is so difficult. So if you can remember to step outside of your busy lives, and this is something I have to remind myself to do every day as well, and to look and see who needs help and what that can be, check in and find out what's going on, especially if someone's come to you in the past for help.
Thank you. Want to add anything to that? Okay. Amy, anything to add?
Sure.
Just a couple of things. Recovery is a very long road. It's not something that happens quickly. When you're not in the midst of it, that can be very hard to understand of why it takes so much time. So I think one thing family members can do is understand that this is a process and to give that couple the space and time without judgment in how long it might take. Another thing that is helpful is...
Could I interrupt you there?
Sure.
And just ask this question?
Sure.
How long on average does it take? That was a question from...
Well, in the recovery world, we often say that we wish each other a long recovery. Long recovery is healthy recovery. So, years. 3 to 5 years, I would say. Okay. Would you agree, Jeff?
To get on track.
To get on track and then to maintain. Then you work your recovery. That can be shocking sometimes, but sometimes we're looking at behaviors that have taken many, many years to develop, and so it takes many, many years to change course. And then recovery, of course, goes into maintenance and then learning how to live healthy, full lives, which is what we hope for. Another thing family members can do, especially for spouses, is to try to withhold lots of advice. Spouses are often in a position of trying to find their own voice. They need to figure it out, even if it looks really messy. And you might have just the thing they need to get their life on track, but we don't want to usurp the process of them learning to find their own voice and learning to figure out their boundaries for themselves. So sometimes even well-meaning advice might come at the wrong time, or you want to give your family member the space to work through their own journey. Probably my last thought on this would be underneath a lot of acting out is the need for being able to connect with your emotions, and that one thing a family member can do is become more and more experienced in vulnerability and in learning to express your feelings, learning to encourage that in your family, to make space for hard things, to make space for uncomfortable conversations, and to support people in their emotional world.
Thank you. President Banger, anything to add on how long that recovery takes? I'm putting him on the spot.
Yeah. It's so variable. It is so variable. It depends on the person and the situation. What I can say to that is that the greater support that they have from those around them and the more transparent their efforts, the faster the healing begins to occur.
Thank you. Do we have any questions that, okay, we need a basketball runner. She's fast. Here she comes.
I know years ago there was an attempt to legislate and get pornography out of the internet, and that was not successful. But could there be a way where we could regulate that all pornography could only be found through a .porn extension rather than having our youth exposed innocently to .com or .org exposures to it?
Clay, do you want to address that?
Yeah, anybody else can as well. I mean, there have been attempts to put it on a .xxx or something of that nature, also having failed in legislation. The reality is that would... It'd be incredibly challenging to go that route. Now, what a more realistic proposition today is kind of following suit with what the UK is trying to do with what Cameron, what's his first name?
David
Cameron is doing in the UK with making an opt-in or opt-out scenario where individuals with the devices will purchase the devices, but they have to opt in to inappropriate content or opt out of the controlled environment, and that would be, they're doing that over in the UK. They're getting a lot of heat from it, and they're getting a lot of pushback. But they're trying it. We'll see if that takes gets implemented successfully, and then we might be able to pursue something here in the United States. However, I will say this: that regardless of whether that's successful or not, any effort to kind of regulate, any efforts to force this type of a change within the United States will be pushed back against, just like it was with prohibition, unless there is a groundswell of knowledge from the people. And so we dedicate ourselves exclusively to the idea that we're trying to decrease demand through education. If the people can rally behind the idea that this is not cool, this is not okay, this is not healthy, and kind of open our eyes to the realities, which is not the common understanding today, policy and laws will follow suit. They will follow the demand of the people. But if we go there first, as we have in the past, if we try to regulate first, there will be such an uproar of pushback that I'm very skeptical that anything will take root or succeed unless first we get the people to demand it. Does that make sense?
Thank you.
Dana? I'd like to add something to that. just a historical note. The Congress tried to prohibit pornography online with the Communications Decency Act, and they passed it around 1996. The Supreme Court struck that down, but existing obscenity laws were never struck down, and they do apply to the internet. So the truth is today, most of the pornography that's out there is a violation of federal law and most state laws right now. And I think Clay got to it. The problem isn't necessarily the law. The problem is no one's enforcing the law. And the reason they're not enforcing the law is because there isn't the public support for it. Now, at a conference like this, we could take a poll and maybe it'd be 98% or 100% in support of enforcing those laws. But the general public has not made this an issue. And if you even remember, even in the last two or three presidential elections, groups like Morality and Media, they were formerly known as the National Center on Sexual Exploitation, had candidate polls, would you enforce obscenity laws? Every attorney general coming up for confirmation hearings, going back to the beginning of President George W. Bush's term, has all said they would enforce obscenity laws. Nobody does it. So there isn't that political will. We could say groundswell of support, maybe we could get our laws enforced, but I think some of the things that Clay's doing in reducing demand, it's almost like we can't do a quick fix solution. We've got to do a long-term solution, and that does involve kind of going back to the beginning. What are our kids, what are the messages they're getting, what's influencing their thinking, how are we protecting them so they're not the next and ongoing generation of people that are being exploited and then becoming exploiters. So
thank you. Just on a personal note and a little plug for Clay, I yesterday was visiting with my 22-year-old daughter, and was talking about this conference and said, why don't you come with me? And she said, no, I got lots of other things to do. And I started talking about it, and then she heard that Clay and his group with Porn Kills Love is here, and she said, oh, I know all about those guys. They are doing an awesome job. They are social media. They are very savvy, and they've gotten the message out. And she told me all about it, and I was impressed. So I had to go look up and read a couple of little articles that have been posted on social media just yesterday evening to find out what she was talking about. And so thank you for what you're doing.
I paid her some money to say that.
I'll see if I can't collect a piece of that. Yes. No microphone. Okay.
Oh, she's coming.
We have two fast basketball players. Thank you.
So in the interim, you know, should the United States ever follow suit in Britain and taking some proactive measures to protect us, is there any devices or programs that we can purchase for our computers that will do the job? NetNanny doesn't work. There are several other programs that don't work. Is there anything that works?
And I'm not an expert at this, but I saw quite a few booths out there. I don't know if you visited the booths out there. Does anybody have anything to add to that? Clay, do it.
Well, I spent a lot of time in that space. Obviously, we don't have our own filter, but I know quite a bit of the others and what they offer. And there's a lot of solutions out there and a lot of new companies coming out addressing this issue. The demand for a technological solution as far as filtering and accountability software is exploding right now. And so the market is following suit. We've got groups out of Portland, one called Circle. You can go to meetcircle.com. They're coming out very shortly. They have a very innovative approach. We've got Pure out there that is coming out early next year that's very innovative and exciting. There's a router-based solutions. I know there's Clean Router out there that you know, do a router-based filtering, and they're very strong. And then there's the device-based solutions, and Covenant Eyes is a very strong organization right now out there, and they have more of an accountability approach. So they can filter, but they actually, their core product isn't a filtering device or a filtering software. It more tracks everything that's happening and then reports that to an accountability partner, and which is really effective for millennials and adults. I think for children, filtration is great, but accountability software is very powerful for individuals that are a little older and a little more savvy. So there's a lot of great things. Now, none of them are perfect. A lot of them are kind of working toward better solutions, but technology is always advancing, and we have a stronger technological push right now with very innovative, strong minds entering the space, more so than any other time, and more competitors are going to be entering the space, which is a good and healthy thing. And so I'm very excited for the future of software and devices, but you're right that it's always, you know, a few steps behind where technology is. But there are some strong, perhaps stronger than you've experienced in the past, solutions today, and even more strong solutions coming in the near future.
Thank you.
I just wanted to say that's why we always say children need an internal filter as well as an external filter. So you can filter a device, but children need to have an internal filter installed by giving them the right information and a plan by which they use to know how to deal with it when they see it.
Yeah, the only thing I'll add on that is that my experience has been that the best approach is a combination of software, accountability, and having the internal filter in the family home environment for children where there's an ongoing discussion and children feel safe to talk about what they see, what they hear, what they experience. You put those three things together, you're going to have a lot more success than just blindly relying on somebody to regulate the internet in the government or some filtering company to protect your family or just talking alone. It's got to be a pretty unified effort with all those different things, and it seems to work really well for most families.
Yeah, you can't just put on a software and kind of think, well, there I go, I'm done. Education has to be a major piece of that equation, and I think that the combination can be the strongest approach.
Any other questions? Way in the back.
back to having attorneys general enforce the laws, what are the most effective ways for a general population to express their desire to have those laws enforced? Is it calling congressmen and writing to people, or is it trying to pass legislation to enforce legislation, or what should we do if we decide to express those views?
Daniel?
I think, like a lot in life, it depends on relationship. And so a citizen, let's just say you want to form a citizens group of concerned people. You can attack a public official for not doing their job, but they're not going to want to work with you at that point. And we've seen that attack happen publicly, and it really hasn't led to any change. We have seen, especially at the local level, where groups are working in a friendly way to educate, say, police chiefs and county or city or county attorneys about the need for these laws to be enforced. And when our public officials know that a large segment of the public has their back, they're more empowered and encouraged to act, because these are really, really unpopular actions to take. And especially at the federal level, we've talked to U.S. attorneys, they're appointed positions, but no U.S. attorney wants to take on an obscenity case. It's the death of their career. It's the absolute death of their career. It gets them nowhere. And all of those are very driven, motivated individuals. They want to advance their career. And so it's very hard to overcome the inertia that's happened. But I think at the local level, we can see things change. That means we can enforce laws against sexually oriented businesses like book clubs, so-called book clubs, gentlemen clubs, massage parlors, and strip clubs. We can get those laws enforced. Those businesses are being shut down every day in America, all across in little communities. That's where our greatest quick impact can happen, but it's going to take a groundswell of relational kind of pushing. And I will say, I didn't say it earlier, but Kristen's point about the public health hazard, we were at a conference last weekend that talked a lot about pornography as a public health hazard. That's the kind of thinking we need to change the public discussion. And until the public discussion changes, these larger, take action steps aren't going to be possible. But it really is changing. It really is changing for the better.
Thank you. Any other questions? One right here. We'll make this our last question. Make it a good one, and all the pressure's on you now.
Well, hi, my name's Karina. If I repeat the same question, I just was at the booth for the new drug, so you don't have to answer me. I don't have any kids, I think of different families that I instantly would go and teach what I've learned. But as a young college student, and I've been affected by dating relationships and relationships in my life from pornography. And so my question, from all that I've learned, just like, I want to be active. Like, now that I've learned, I want to act now. And so what is the best way as a member of this community? How do we educate, or how are we an example? But how do they know that we are an example? How do we reach out and teach children and families and kids? And can I make a difference?
I know you can in your own family, but let's have someone address that. Kristen, do you want it?
Well, I get this question a lot, and I think it's wonderful that there are people like you, and I think many people here want to make a difference. And so how do you do that? Well, you start with your own circle of influence, and then you work out from there. On my website, and if you contact me, pornproofkids@gmail.com, I can send you an outline. We call it a do-it-yourself workshop outline, and it's just an outline of a workshop that you could hold at a community center, at a library, at your church, that has a lot of the points that we've discussed today, as well as far as prevention goes. So that's one resource. We're going to be coming out with more resources because we want to empower people like you to then go out and influence in your sphere of influence and in your social media sphere of influence.
Thank you. What a wonderful conference this has been. Let's just take 1 second again and give a round of applause to all these presenters. Thank you for your time and your effort that you put in. And thank you for coming and being a part of this. Now, I hope that we can all go and do some of these things and become involved. Think in your mind, what can I do? What can I do next? And then go out there and do something. Again, thank you for coming.